From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. We're dedicating today's show to the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. First up, a documentary made from thousands of hours of video and audio that shows an untold story of Apollo 11. Then, how director Damien Chazelle approached Neil Armstrong's personal life in his film, First Man.
Taking one of the most famous achievements in history and trace step by step how this fantasy was turned into reality and just what the sacrifices involved were.
And how the sound design of that film was made from things like subway cars and elephants. That's all coming up on The Frame.
Hi, this is Larry Mantle. Join me for our next Film Week screening, Boogie Nights. The screening Saturday night, July 27th at the Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown L.A. Tickets at kpcc.org/in-person.
Whether you watched the lunar landing live 50 years ago, or like me, listened on the radio on a family camping trip, or saw it years later, the documentary Apollo 11 will be something that you've never seen or heard before. And that's because it's largely assembled from thousands of hours of previously unseen footage and unheard audio. Late in 2016, the documentary's director, Todd Douglas Miller, was scouring for footage of the Apollo 11 mission, and one day he made a key discovery. Here's Todd Douglas Miller.
Some of the research team at National Archives had come across in May of 2017 some reels. And, you know, they didn't say exactly what was on them. They were labeled Apollo 11. Some had the dates of the launch, which was July 16th, 1969 on them. We put them on the scanner, and needless to say, our jaws were just absolutely on the floor.
This is the 65-millimeter footage, right? It's almost as big as an IMAX frame now.
That's correct. So suffice it to say, that was one part of it.
Yeah, you're just talking about the visuals. There's also 11,000 hours of audio recordings. Is that right?
It was actually 18,000 hours of Apollo Air mission control audio. 11,000 hours, as you said, were directly related to Apollo 11.
Now 5 minutes, 52 seconds, and counting.
Booster flight.
CPSS, verify go for launch.
CPSS, verify go for launch.
CTSC, verify go for launch.
Booster flight.
Verify go for launch. SRO, verify go for launch.
As I've told people before, who have asked about how do you start editing? There is a 9-day version of the film that exists.
A little longer than most films.
Yeah, just a little bit longer, but we tried to get every available piece, every single frame, every single audio clip that we could, and lay it out in a timeline so we could see what we got.
You made a decision very early on about the nature of the story, and that was going to be there wasn't going to be talking heads. There weren't going to be people explaining what was happening at any given moment. The footage and the audio would more or less speak for itself. Why was that decision important, and how did it dictate what you were and were not going to use?
Yeah, it was always the plan from the start, even before the large format came out. If you were around during the missions, you listened to them. They had a wonderful quote-unquote narrator and the public affairs officer. There was anywhere from 4 to 5 in each mission. He sat in mission control right next to all the other flight controllers back behind the flight director and basically distilled down all the technical jargon that was being said on the air-to-ground transmissions between the astronauts and mission control.
We have some 7.6 million pounds of thrust pushing the vehicle upward. A vehicle that weighs close to 6.5 million pounds.
Every time I heard those guys, I just thought that they would it'd be a wonderful use of kind of being in the moment narration. So it was always the intention to just let the visuals speak for themselves.
We're talking with Todd Douglas Miller about his film Apollo 11. You also make a thematic choice to talk about process and not about heroes. And that is about the people who are behind the scenes. There's a sequence toward the end of the film where one of the astronauts is thanking the people who actually built the spacecraft. Why was that important?
Well, I think you can't tell the story of Apollo 11 or any of the other Apollo missions and the overall program without doing the research of who these people were. And the minute you ask that question, you're immediately exposed to numbers. Hundreds of thousands of people spread across tens of thousands of companies. And it always just struck me. And then to see footage of the workers, footage of not only mission control in the firing room, people that built the spacecraft, people that built the machinery to transport the spacecraft. One thing that was never lost on me in any of the footage was how young the mission controllers were, how young all the people were. I think there's a misunderstood theme with that era. Just because it was 50 years old, it was these, you know, older people that were working on it. Not so. Most of those flight controllers were in their 20s. The astronauts themselves were in their late 30s. They were the veterans. People looked up to them.
I'm going to play a piece of music. It's a song by John Stewart called Mother Country.
Oh, Mother Country, I do love you.
It's probably not a song that a lot of people know about, but it plays a central role in the astronauts' return to Earth. How does it figure into the story, and how did you hear about it?
Well, when we first got the audio, not only this, 11,000 hours, but we also had the onboard, the air to ground, and on one of the onboard tracks, my producing partner, Tom Peterson, actually found this. We kind of had a divide and conquer approach. We had so much audio. We were enlisting everyone to listen to, you know, hours and hours of footage. And Tom was just walking to work one day listening to, you know, the onboard audio. He's played it for me a million times. I've played it myself another million. I still can barely make out that song. But sure enough, shortly before the guys went to bed, Buzz, just like in the movie, says, "Hey, you guys want to play some music?" And about three or four songs in was this amazing track by this folk artist, John Stewart. He has since passed away, but his wife, Buffy Ford Stewart, we tracked her down. They never had heard this. John didn't know about it. They were friends of all these astronauts. John himself wrote a song. He was so inspired by Apollo 11. He wrote a song called Armstrong.
But don't you know she heard it on that July afternoon? She heard a man named Armstrong had walked upon the moon.
So it's it was a real honor to present his music for the first time in the film.
Todd Douglas Miller is the director of Apollo 11. Todd, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
The feature-length documentary, Apollo 11, can be seen in select theaters. A shorter version is on the IMAX screen at the California Science Center. Coming up on The Frame, we know the legend of Neil Armstrong. The movie First Man tries to understand the person. You know this. 50 years ago tomorrow, Neil Armstrong stepped off the ladder of the Apollo 11 and onto the surface of the moon. So how do you make a dramatic movie about the astronaut when everybody knows the ending? That was the challenge for director Damien Chazelle and screenwriter Josh Singer in First Man. The film stars Ryan Gosling as Armstrong. The movie opened in theaters last fall, but it arrives on HBO tomorrow. I spoke with Chazelle and Singer at the 2018 Telluride Film Festival, where the movie premiered. Here's Damien Chazelle.
I think what really fascinated me at the outset was taking one of the most famous achievements in history, one that we just think of as a success story, a sort of fait accompli. You grow up, you see the photos, and you hear the one-liners, and you kind of soak in the mythology. But try to take that, rewind to when none of that stuff had happened, when it all seemed actually quite ludicrous and crazy to a bunch of people, and trace step by step how this fantasy was turned into reality and just what the sacrifices involved were.
Josh, Neil was famously private. He didn't like talking at all about himself, but he did cooperate with one author about a book, James Hansen, on the book First Man. And that gives you a lot of information. But where do you go beyond that? What does the book leave out? Where do you go to do additional research that builds on what he shared with Hansen in that biography?
Yeah, so, I mean, Jim really did yeoman's work, and his book is encyclopedic. And what's amazing is as you dive deeper and deeper, there are just incredible chestnuts he uncovered that a lot of people didn't know. Most of the people who worked with Neil never knew he had a daughter. Most of the people who worked with Neil didn't know that, you know, he struggled a bit with the X-15 right around when Karen died. So there was just, they were right off the bat, Jim's work was just an incredible starting point. But it's true, we wanted to go deeper. And first of all, we had Jim himself. He had a ton of knowledge. He had his own original notes from his conversations with Neil and Janet and all sorts of other folks. And NASA and Jim just opened these doors for us at Johnson, tons of former astronauts. And then Neil's family. We got to sit with Janet. We got to talk to June, Neil's sister, who was probably one of the closer people in the world to him. And his kids, Rick and Mark, were just incredibly supportive. And, you know, all of these people not only gave us primary information, but then read draft upon draft upon draft and gave us notes, which was incredibly helpful.
Damien, a lot of people who have paid attention to the space program over the last 20 or 30 years imagine that it's really dangerous because of the Challenger and the Columbia accidents. But until the Challenger accident in 1986, no American astronaut had died in space. The Apollo fire that killed Roger Chaffee, Gus Grissom, and Ed White in 1967 was on the launch pad, but test pilots were really risking their lives every time they got inside a vehicle. And I think a lot of people don't really understand that what Neil Armstrong was doing before he became an astronaut was far more dangerous than what astronauts were doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, it's sort of, you have to look at the percentage. You know, obviously there's less space flights, so less percentage of, I mean, it's hard to say that being a test pilot at that time was actually more dangerous than being an astronaut. Basically, I think the key is just that it was one was an extension of the other, that these were all former test pilots, or almost all former test pilots. These also were almost all former wartime pilots. So it's true that everyone, not just Neil, but everyone around him, in those first groups of astronauts in the early 60s, they came into that program with the great awareness of their proximity to death at all times on this job. And I think that became really fascinating to me, was just how they coped with that, how they dealt with it. Felt like a lot of them dealt with it by modern standards, by not dealing with it. But, you know, how do you kind of do a day-by-day job that, you know, whether you're an astronaut or a test pilot, that in many ways could seem like a normal middle-class kind of job. These astronauts and their families lived seemingly normal middle-class lives, with the exception that every time they went off on a flight or a mission, or often training, we often forget how many astronauts died training, some of which we go into in the film. How do you deal with the fact that you may not ever come back? How do you deal with those odds? How do you deal with, how does your family deal?
Neil, I was sorry to hear about your daughter. I'm sorry, is there a question? What I mean is, do you think it will have an effect? I think it would be unreasonable to assume that it wouldn't have some effect.
You know, because the myth has become so set in stone in some ways of these guys and how they behaved, you know, I think it almost suggests that they didn't feel, right? We heard a lot like, oh, people would, you know, they'd be at funerals and they'd check their watch. When can we get back to work? And Robert Perlman, who was one of our great advisors, he said, when I saw Neil crying, you know, after Karen dies, it totally changed my perception of who Neil was. I'd never thought of that guy. And obviously Neil would cry when his daughter dies, right? And he does it in a very Neil way, you know, but I think, you know, trying to get underneath the myth, trying to puncture that myth. And I think that's why, you know, focusing on the loss and the tragedy and the sacrifice was so important to us.
I think that it was also, just to jump in, one thing that was super important to Ryan. I think I was looking at this story primarily as a story about a goal and the cost of a goal, sort of what you're running to as opposed to what you're running from. And Ryan, I think, more than anything, sort of gravitated towards what Neil was running from. It was actually Ryan, I think, who pushed us to show Neil actually immediately emote in a sort of outward way, even though it's very hidden from everyone else, upon the death of his daughter, and to kind of try to create a sort of primal scene there that's going to drive you eventually to the moon. And I think that actually became that sort of balance between the emotions you show, the emotions you don't show, the astronaut culture that suppresses all those emotions, and then the realities of being a father, being a husband, that became actually the big emotional balancing act for all of us, for me, Ryan, Josh, all of us making the film.
We're talking with Damien Chazelle, the director of First Man, and Josh Singer, the film screenwriter. Josh, I'm going to ask you about Neil Armstrong's first wife, Janet, who's played by Claire Foy in the film. What was important about their story that you thought was critical to the film?
Well, my wife, who's the real writer in the family, she's a wonderful novelist, and she's always my emotional center, you know. And she talked about how there's something about their relationship where it seems like they really were quite loving, you know, and really loved each other. I mean, they lived up in this little cabin up in Juniper Hills when Neil was flying out at Edwards. And, you know, it had like, it didn't have a washing machine. It didn't have hot water, you know, and they loved it. Right, which just sort of says it's the almost idyllic, which is how Damien and Linus beautifully shoot it in the movie. But, you know, and it goes from there to where they eventually, you know, later in the 90s, divorce, right? And so many of these families divorced. And what my wife would say was, you know, it's like how many blows can love sustain? They have real love, but these blows, one after another after another.
Jen, you have to trust us. We've got this under control.
No, you don't. All these protocols and procedures to make it seem like you have it under control. But you're a bunch of boys making models out of balsa wood. You don't have anything under control.
It just takes such a toll. And seeing that love fracture, seeing them, you know, sort of forced apart both by these tragedies and by the demands of the job, that arc wound up being, I think, really very important to us.
Damien, the astronauts at this time were all white men. Almost everybody who ran NASA at the time was a white man. There were some people in Mission Control who might have been African American. But at the time that this is all happening, Vietnam War is going on. There are still very important civil rights battles that are being fought. And you stop the movie for a little bit and look at those issues. Why was it important to frame what all these white guys were doing in the context of what was happening in the rest of the country at the time?
One thing I just didn't know much at all before I started researching this movie about the space program was how controversial it was, especially in those in that latter part of the 60s. Obviously, 69, when they actually landed on the moon, if you look at the kind of chart, approval rating chart, there's a spike, a big spike at that moment, but everything before then, and then quite quickly after, was very divided, hovering around 50%, if not much lower, for the expenditure and the whole idea of the space program. Why are we sending men to the moon while we're trying to send men to the moon, because again, we hadn't even done it yet, while people can't eat, while cities are burning, and while, you know, people are being sent off to die in Vietnam. And that was the other fascinating thing to me, was actually in the ways in which, for certain commentators at the time, Vietnam and the space program were actually part of the same equation. There's the same military-industrial equation. It's all about, hey, I mean, the Saturn rocket looks a lot like a bomb, and it goes off like a bomb, you know? And I think the irony of that was something that Josh and I wanted to certainly comment on. I just think it makes it much more interesting in a way to, instead of sugarcoating that stuff, to really try to look at it, try to contextualize Neil and his sort of bubble of the community against that backdrop. It just puts it in perspective in a way that, again, I think is important to have a full understanding of what this experience was.
Josh and Damien, great to see you. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
First Man can be seen on HBO starting on July 20th. Coming up on The Frame, how the sound editors for First Man used some unusual elements to create the film's immersive sound. We just heard from the director and screenwriter of First Man. For the sound editors of that film about Neil Armstrong, their task was to use sound design to put audiences into rockets and onto the moon. The Frame's Monica Bushman spoke with the two women who received an Oscar nomination for the sounds of the film.
My name is Mildred Iatru Morgan, and I'm the supervising sound editor on First Man.
Jiminy 8, this is Houston Capcom. Please stand by to copy.
I got my room like this. Look at all these papers. I
know. My name is Eileen Lee. I'm the sound designer, supervising sound editor, and re-recording mixer on First Man.
I had all my crayons in that, and now look at all the crayons.
This film is mostly a quiet, personal, intimate film. It almost felt like you're watching someone's 16 millimeter home movie. And so to kind of match what we see, you know, the grainy texture, we needed to give it sort of like an unpolished feel.
Rick? Okay, out here now.
Normally when we edit dialogue on a film, our mission is to clean it up as much as possible to get rid of any artifacts so that you just hear the dialogue. In this case, Damien made it very clear that he wanted the Earth scenes, the scenes on Earth, the intimate scenes amongst the family, the scenes that, you know, with the astronauts working on Earth, he wanted it to sound like a documentary.
I got one. Who did what?
Damien liked to say that this movie covers the moon and the kitchen sink. And the kitchen sink are all those scenes where the family's at home and they're arguing and the kids are playing and running around and making a mess, in contrast with the world of NASA.
T-minus 1 minute and counting on the Atlas Agena launch.
The Gemini 8 mission is actually Neil Armstrong's first trip to space. And that mission is really important to the Apollo mission. So a lot was like hanging on Neil Armstrong's shoulders. So how Damien wanted to start the Gemini 8 mission was his long walk to be seated into the Gemini 8 capsule and being strapped in. Damien had always wanted this sound of like this slow cycling feeling of tension, this slow boiling tension that's, you know, building up. And we just took that inspiration and used sounds that we could see and hear in that sequence, such as like, you know, steam releases or actually dry cleaner steam. We would like Doppler it or pitch manipulate it so it sounds like this. It's on this cycling rhythmic beat. And as it goes along, we introduce low rhythmic thumps that almost sound like a heartbeat that's metallic, which are actually like subway clunks and thumps. So all of these were built up tension and increasingly built up to a point where, like, no, the door shut. This door are really ancient and heavy. It's like you've been trapped and locked in and you have nowhere else to go. And then to put you back into Neil's perspective, you only hear Neil's breathing. During the Gemini launch, because we are always inside the cockpit with the astronauts, never really showing what's happening outside, the sound has to carry a lot of the energy and to keep building in intensity. So we started off the sequence with real rocket launch sounds to add on to that, to help with the anger and fury of the machine that is pushing them up to space. We started coming up with like using different animal vocals like elephants, lions. Manipulate that pitch and so that they just sound like, you know, they are just screaming and roaring out of these turbines. To have this visceral sense of anxiety felt by the characters.
For me, my biggest challenge on First Man was dealing with Neil Armstrong's famous words on the moon.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Early on in the editing process, Tom Cross, the picture editor, sent me Ryan Gosling's performance of those words, and which were very similar to what Neil Armstrong said. But Tom said to me, can you get it even closer? Can you get it to the point where it sounds like it could be Neil Armstrong? So I spent a lot of time on that, making sure the rhythm was exactly the same.
I'm going to step off the limb now.
Stealing the static from the original and blending it in. And then at the very end, when I sort of had it all kind of close to where I wanted it, I used a plug-in to manipulate the pitch of some of Ryan Gosling's a couple of words and a couple even syllables so that it sounded as close as I could possibly get it.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Subsequently, when we show the film, I've had people come up to me and say, oh, you actually used Neil Armstrong there. And it's like, no, we didn't. That's Ryan Gosling. So that's always incredibly satisfying when I hear that from people.
And that is it for the week. Thanks to the team that safely lands the frame every day. And thanks to Taylor McFerrin, who provides our opening theme music. I'm John Horn. We're back here on Monday. Have a great weekend.